We are going to go through a little bit about how we keep time for this type of an oral argument conducted by video. Attorney Lohr, you're muted at the moment. But when it's your time to speak, you know how to fix your microphone so that you're able to speak. Okay, very good. What we're going to do is my marshal is going to show you our timekeeping, and when it's time to start, you'll see a green sign. It'll say start. When you have 5 minutes left to go in that portion of your argument, you'll have a yellow sign. And then when it's time to stop, you'll have a red sign that says stop. I will try to help you keep track of the time because it's sometimes hard, particularly if you're reading a quote to the court or whatever, you're not looking at the screen. And since we don't have the lights that you're used to using for oral argument, sometimes it's a little difficult to keep track of the time. If you're answering a justice's question, I would always let you finish, but I probably won't let you start on a new topic once you get to the red light. So if you are both prepared to proceed, I will call our first case for the morning, State versus Loaiza. Counsel, are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
Please do.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders representing the state of Wisconsin. The issue in this case is how many convictions Mr. Loaiza had when he was convicted of OWI yet again in this case. The state presented to the court his Department of Transportation record, which was reliable, competent proof that he had 8 convictions, 3 from Wisconsin, 3 from the state of California, and 5 from Wisconsin. Here we are only dealing with one of those convictions, the one from 1990 from the state of California. The circuit court recognized that the state proved that conviction with the Department of Transportation record and with the materials from the 1991 conviction in the state of California, in which Loaiza admitted to having 3 prior convictions, including the one in this case from 1990. But the Court of Appeals reversed, and it found that the materials from the 1990 case so undermined the Department of Transportation record that the state hadn't even proved the conviction by a preponderance of the evidence. When it did so, the Court of Appeals showed that it fundamentally misunderstood and misapplied the preponderance of the evidence standard. So the state is asking this court to do 2 things. First of all, reverse the decision of the appellate court, which is plainly wrong. And second, explain to courts how they should assess a Department of Transportation record or a judgment of conviction, which proves a conviction, and how it should apply the preponderance of the evidence standard. So in this case, the state proved the 1990 conviction at least 3 times. The department record, his Department of Transportation record shows it. As this court and the Court of Appeals has said over and over again in Spaeth and Weideman and Van Riper and Braunschweig, a Department of Transportation record which shows a conviction is reliable, competent proof of that conviction. It, of course, can be...
Mr. Sanders, good morning. Can I ask you something about that? I understand that that's what the law is, but isn't it true in this case that one of the priors that shows up on the Department of Corrections record was kicked before they even got to this issue? That is that we already know that this Department of Transportation record from Wisconsin is not accurate as to, isn't it the 19... It was the 91 or the 89 conviction, correct?
Well, the circuit court had said that it wasn't going to count the one from 1989. And for what that's worth, it's wrong. The state did not appeal that because the department, me, I didn't know about that. Had I known, we may well have appealed it. And because you get the same, the law treats an offense the same if it's a 7th, 8th, or 9th. When the court resentenced him, he got the same sentence. So there wasn't a lot of reason for the state to appeal. However, had the state appealed, I would be making exactly the same claims I make now, which is that the court erred.
Okay, thank you.
Because we proved it three different times. And the first was with the department record. And that is reliable. It is competent. As courts have found, in a case in which the state is required to prove a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, such as in a case where the defendant is charged with a PAC above 02, where the state has to prove three of them, if we submit a department record which shows three, and it's not and the defendant fails to rebut that, that is enough to prove the conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So we have that. Then we have the fact that in 1991 in the state of California, the defendant pled to a 4th offense. The state had alleged that he had three convictions from one from 1987, which we don't count here because it was pre-1989, one from 1989 and one from 1990, which is the one here. And he pled to a 4th, and when he did it, he admitted to his 1990 conviction. And he did so on a form which a judge signed. And he did so at a hearing where he had an attorney. So there's no question that there he admitted to his 1990 conviction in that state. And then as a third thing, we have the fact that in this case, he collaterally attacked of his convictions from that state in 89, 90, and 91. And when he did so, he said, I was convicted in these three cases, but I don't recall if when I was convicted, I had an attorney. So he admitted it. And as our law has shown, again, in all of those cases, Spaeth and Weideman and Van Riper and Braunschweig, if a defendant admits to a conviction, it's proved. And he has done it twice. So he has confirmed that his department record, which shows the conviction, is right. So with that, then when the appellate court found that the state hadn't proved it, it found that somehow, even though he admitted it twice and the department record shows it, the department record is so unreliable that it doesn't count to even prove it by a preponderance of the evidence, excuse me. And when it did that, it gave no weight to the department record.
And so I'm going to ask about the second sort of issue you raise that suggests that a defendant needs to be required to prove that the record's inaccurate when a due to driving record is put forward. It strikes me as not consistent with our general standard that we say we review everything by preponderance of the evidence, that it's sort of establishing an artificial evidentiary barrier. Why isn't Why isn't just requiring the state to prove by a preponderance of the evidence and whatever evidence is brought forward is brought forward? Why isn't that the standard, and why shouldn't that continue to be the standard?
To be clear, I may have gone a little far in my brief, and I tried to walk that back in the reply brief, and I want to do so now. I am not in any way saying that it is the defendant's burden to prove anything. And my brief may have read that way, and I apologize for that. It is not the defendant's burden. It's the state's burden. It's always the state's burden. It is by a preponderance. That's all. But I think what the court should make clear to courts, because I don't think the Court of Appeals in this case applied that properly, that once the state submits a department record or a judgment of conviction, which lists it, if there's nothing more, that is enough. So while it's not the defendant's burden to do more, if he doesn't show something that would rebut that, he is going to lose.
Well, I think we would say that we've already said it can be enough, right? So why would we need to say anything more than that? It might depend on the quality of the record or what it looks like, right? I mean, maybe you're right as a practical matter that somebody would need to practically challenge it, but I'm worried about setting up some sort of artificial, rebuttable presumption about what the quality of certain kind of evidence. We've already said the DOT dry record is enough. That's clear, clear can be enough, right? On which a court can rely. So are you asking us to do something? It sounds like you're asking us to do something beyond that, to say it is enough unless they present something else, regardless of the quality of it, regardless of any questions or something. I'm not sure. Maybe you can help me out with that.
I'm not exactly sure either. And I am not trying to get the court to place a burden on the defendant. I don't want to say that after the state meets its burden, it then shifts to the defendant. I'm not saying that, even if it may have read as though I was saying that. I am not saying that. So I guess it's just unclear what exactly a court needs to know, because I think that the opinion in this case shows that the court did not understand how this works, and it simply didn't give weight to the department record. And instead it looked for doubt, and it found only a lack of additional evidence, which on its own would have proved the conviction. And that doesn't make any sense, because it essentially weighed a department record against what if you look at it properly, is absolutely nothing, and said that somehow makes the department record unreliable to an extent that it is no longer a preponderance of the evidence. So I don't know what exactly the court can say other than to just say that the way the court weighed it here is wrong, that it can't be that. There must be something that would make a court or a department record, which is reliable and which is competent, so unreliable that it's not even a preponderance. In this case, all the court looked at to say that the department record was not even reliable by a preponderance was the lack of evidence in one file from 1990, which didn't show to the court that he was convicted in that case. So it said you don't have a judgment, which is fine, because we don't need one, because if we did, then a department record would never be enough if it were only enough if you also had a judgment which said the same thing. But you don't need that, as the courts have said in a lot of cases. So the fact that we don't have it is not proof that it's not, that it did not happen. The court also looked to what was in the court record from that case and said that because there is no indication that he was placed on probation, the fact that it shows that he was revoked is somehow not enough to show that he was ever placed on probation, which is silly. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. Of course, the only thing you could draw from him being revoked was that he was placed on probation. And to one thing which is not in my brief, because I looked again at the court file from 1990 last night, and I think I understand it now. He was charged in the municipal court in 1990, and that court had his case. Then what is in the record from that case is only the complaint and the plea form. Then there is a docket sheet from another case, which was a case in the Superior Court, which has a new case number. And that case says that all that is in that case file are things after 1-1-91. He pled in that case in May of 90. So all of the documentation for his case would have been in the file in the municipal court, and we have almost nothing from that case. So what we do have, though, in the newer case, it shows that he at that point had two counts. It's on page one, and this is on in the appendix to the state's brief. It's all appended, and the new case file starts on page 167 of the state's appendix, and it shows a new case number for that case, and it shows that he had one count on page 167. Count one was for 23152A, which is a drunk driving. Count two, 14601.2, is for the equivalent of an OAR. Then on page 169 of the appendix, it says for case events occurring before 010191, see case file number 218M258, which is his case in the municipal court. And then on page 170, it says that he is revoked. And on count one, he now has to serve 4 months in jail. So the only way to read this is that he was charged in the municipal court in his first case, which was 218M258. He then pled in that case to a drunk driving and to an OAR. Then in his newer case in the Superior Court, that started because of a bench warrant. And then once that case started, that was when he was revoked, and then he got 4 months, and he was revoked on count one, which is his drunk driving. And I know that that's a lot to throw at the court at the last minute. I honestly did not see this until last night, but it makes sense to me that that's why we don't have much, because we have a court record, two of them from 1990. Courts can throw these things away. And so we've only got a couple documents from each case, and there's absolutely nothing there which should lead a court to think that he was not convicted of a drunk driving. And the court took from only this that he was not, and that made his department Wisconsin record so unreliable that it shouldn't count. And that's just nonsense, because the court failed to see what is in the record. But even if that's not the case, the court failed to examine what the circuit court found proved his 1990 conviction, which is all of the documentation from his 1991 case, where it's plain on the record. He pled to a fourth. He admitted three priors, one from 87, one from 89, and one from 90. And he admitted to his OAR from 1990. So he admitted to both of his convictions in this case. And at the time, he had an attorney and a judge signed it. It's clear on the record. In the complaint, it showed he had three priors. It's got the dates. It's got the date that he drove drunk and the date on which he pled. And he admitted to all three, and it says it in the record. The circuit court found from that alone, it could have found that he has a conviction in 1990. The appellate court didn't even mention it. Instead, it only looked to what was not in the record for his 1990 case, but had it examined the entire record like it said it was going to, it had to find that he said he did it. He admitted to it.
Mr. Sanders, I think if we crafted the rule based on the facts of this case, needless to say, it would be very, very, very fact specific.
Absolutely.
So I want to go back to what Justice Hagedorn was asking you, and your response to his question about the, I'm going to call it burden shifting, even though I hear you, you're not asking for burden shifting anymore. We'll call it the second issue in this case. And Justice Hagedorn asked you some questions about that. And he asked you, you said, I'm not actually asking for the burden to shift. So let's go back to what the Court of Appeals said. And then I want to hear what your response is to what should the rule be. This is what the Court of Appeals says in paragraph 7 of their opinion. I'm starting at the second sentence. A DOT record may be sufficiently reliable when that is the only information available, but additional information may cast doubt on the reliability of a DOT entry to a degree that makes the entry insufficiently reliable to meet the state's burden, which we have already established is by a preponderance. What, if anything, should be changed from that rule as set out by the Court of Appeals in this case? What are you advocating for?
From that rule, I think the one part that I don't agree with is when it says that if all we have is a department record, it may be sufficiently reliable. If that's all we have, it just is. It is sufficiently reliable, if that's all there is, because I think any court who sees a department record and there's nothing else, there is no claim by a defendant that it's wrong, there's nothing else, a court is always going to find that that is enough.
So I want to push back on you a little bit, Mr. Attorney Sanders, on that. The way we have this stated is that it may be sufficiently reliable. So you want us to say that always it's reliable? I mean, that's what I'm hearing from you is, hey, game over. They produced the record, game over. That almost makes it, why would you ever be looking at other evidence? Aren't there times that it, for whatever reason, it may not be reliable? Maybe it's incomplete. Maybe it's unclear what the actual conviction was for. I mean, can you foresee some times that maybe it's not reliable?
Well, I just meant that what the court said is a department record may be sufficiently reliable when that is the only information that is available. So if there is something more, of course, then it might not be. I guess it doesn't really matter if this court said it just always is reliable, because I think a court is probably always going to find it is unless there's something more.
So doesn't it matter to the burden shifting idea? I mean, you acknowledge that you might have gone a little too far in your brief, and that's one thing that we need to be cognizant of, is that we're not shifting the burden on the onto the defendant and saying something is always reliable. Now you, defendant, have to go show it's not.
Well, I think it's a practical matter. If there is a department record and there's nothing else, I can't imagine a case in which a court is not going to find that that is proof of what it shows. The department record is something that we can get in under 90803, even without a witness, because it is presumed to be so reliable that we don't even need that. So I can't imagine a case in which a court is going to say, yeah, it shows it. It shows that he's got a conviction on this date for this, but, and I've got nothing else. And I think what the court should, in this case at least, know is that he's never once claimed he was not convicted on that date. There's never been a single claim. He has twice said, I was convicted on that date, both when he pled in his 91 case and when he collaterally attacked it here. He's never, ever claimed I was not, that that isn't real, that I was not convicted in that case. In a case where a defendant did say that, then of course the court should look at more if there is more. But, and while it's not the defendant's, it's not like he has to show that it's wrong, but as a practical matter, if there's nothing else, a court is, I think, going to find it's right. And so there has to be something more. He can choose not to, but then, well, how is the court going to find that it shouldn't count a department record, which is so reliable that it comes in under 90803? I see my time is over.
Good, very good. Thank you. Attorney Laura, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Lohr, and I am representing Alfonso Loayza. This case is about how the state should weigh evidence of an alleged prior OWI conviction when there is competing evidence about that conviction for the purpose of enhancing a sentence. The decision below, which held that the state's evidence was insufficient to prove the 1990 conviction, should be upheld for two reasons. The first is because the evidence that was before the court when weighed as a whole, as the Court of Appeals did, does not satisfy the state's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Loayza was actually convicted of a qualifying OWI offense in 1990 rather than the operating while suspended or revoked. The state now argues that the court weighed that evidence wrong, but the state did not argue that before the Court of Appeals. I think that's important. The state's only argument before the Court of Appeals was that because of the existence of the DOT record, it was essentially a game over and that it had been proven. I'm happy to hear that the state has walked back its argument regarding burden shifting, because the Court of Appeals was also correct for the second reason of it is the state's burden to prove elements required for sentence enhancement. And even the state's sort of walked back argument today that a defendant is still required to show something or to actually themselves deny that a prior conviction exists has no support in case law. And this court should not create such a rule. I'd also like to highlight what this case is not about off the front. And this case is not about whether a Wisconsin DOT record by itself is sufficient proof of a prior conviction. That question has already been decided by Van Riper in the Court of Appeals, and that's not at issue here today. So this decision below does not conflict with Van Riper, because the DOT record is not the only evidence before the court. This case is also not about a defendant using the fact of lost or destroyed case files to argue that there is no proof of an older prior conviction. Here, the state requested and received the 1990 California case file. And the state presented that case file to the sentencing court as proof that the prior conviction existed. So the problem for the state in this case is not that the case records don't exist. It's that they do exist, but they don't support a finding that there was a qualifying OWI conviction in 1990.
Counsel, I want to ask about your opposing counsel listed a couple of ways, three different ways that that he argued that the record supports here. And obviously our review is de novo in looking at the record. In your brief, page 14, you say this. It said, the fact that Loaiza pled, did I pronounce Loaiza? Is that the correct way?
Loaiza, correct.
Loaiza, thank you. The fact that Loaiza pled guilty to charges stemming from a criminal complaint that alleged a 1990 prior offense is not proof of what happened in the 1990 case. Why not? I mean, if he pled guilty to this and he acknowledged that he had committed that later on, why would that not be enough? His court admissions, as your your opposing counsel arguments.
Yes. Well, with respect to that, the 1991 plea, I think, first of all, this court has never held that a plea in a previous case is sufficient to prove the number of prior convictions. That is, just because someone pleads to an OWI fourth in a prior case, the state doesn't automatically win on charging them with an OWI fifth on the next one. Second, I would argue that because this was a California case, we don't know what the California law and procedure was relating to whether that was an element of the offense that the defendant was admitting to, or how the state had proven those offenses at the time of the plea. I think there's just too many questions relating to that document for it to be proof in the face of what we have in the 1990 case file. So perhaps if we had the DOT record and the 1991 case file alone, we could say that that was enough proof. But because we have this 1990 case file containing records that really call into question the existence of that conviction for the OWI offense versus for another offense, I don't think that the 1991 plea form overcomes that or makes it more reliable.
What about the collateral attack in this case? Would you respond to that argument?
Yes. I would respond to that argument in several ways. First, the affidavit that Mr. Loaiza signed was not an admission of prior convictions. What he attested to was that he had no memory of what happened in these cases at all. With regards to the actual motion that was filed that does say it's that he is collaterally attacking the convictions, I would argue that that was drafted by counsel. It was drafted somewhat, I would argue, inartfully, given that he had not admitted this and he was essentially saying he had no memory of these cases. While this court has held that defense counsel can admit a prior conviction for a defendant in the OWI context, it is never held that the filing of a collateral attack or a statement by counsel before sentencing constitutes an admission. And I think that the fact that Mr. Loaiza conditioned his plea on holding the state to its burden and the state affirmatively agreed and accepted that bargain that they would bring proof to sentencing severs any admission that defense counsel may have made with that collateral attack motion and shows that Mr. Loaiza himself was not admitting to that prior offense.
The standard, of course, is preponderance of the evidence. So we I think that the challenge you face in those, even if I agreed with the point that you're making, is that we just need to find it's more likely than not. An admission in court that you were convicted and you want to challenge old offenses seems to sure make it more likely than not that you might have had an older offense.
Well, Again, I would highlight the fact that Mr. Loaiza's affidavit does not make that admission. His admission is that he has no memory of these cases. And I would also draw the court's attention to the Spaeth case, in which the defense counsel at sentencing was asked by the court if we were looking at a jail case. And the defense counsel agreed, yes, this is a jail case. And the state tried to use that statement by defense counsel as an admission of the prior operating after revocations, because it wouldn't be a jail case unless the defendant had that specific number of prior offenses. The court held that that admission by counsel was not sufficient. And so essentially, if it's going to be an admission by counsel, and by the defendant as well, it has to be more specific so that the defendant or defense counsel is actually affirming that these convictions happened and that they were for the OWI offense. So we would just argue that that is not the case with respect to the collateral attack motion.
Attorney Lohr, in your brief, you respond to Mr. Sanders' argument that the sentence that your client received when he was revoked from probation in California, and I'm looking at Appendix 170 that is attached to Mr. Sanders' brief, and that document indicates that he was revoked from probation on the OWI charge and then was ordered to serve 4 months in jail. And that seems to me pretty strong proof. That would seem to me to be over the preponderance, more likely than not, standard to show that he was convicted. Because I don't know, and I think this is how Mr. Sanders phrased it in his brief. I don't have it exactly, the exact wording, but how could someone's probation be revoked if they were never placed on probation for having been convicted of the crime in the first place? I'm paraphrasing you, Mr. Sanders, and I hope I'm doing you justice. But Ms. Lohr, I'm interested to know your response to that.
Well, it seems silly to argue, but there is no evidence that he was placed on probation. Obviously, I think we can all assume that he was, because there is evidence that he was revoked from probation. But it's not clear from the record what offense he was placed on probation for. And I do acknowledge that it says count one, and that count one corresponds with the OWI offense. But given that there's no evidence that he actually was convicted of that count, I think it is questionable that that's why he was placed on probation. We have a plea form that states he was pleading only to the operating after revocation count.
Let me ask you about that, though. It is possible for there to have been more than one plea form at that hearing. I mean, certainly, I've been involved in hearings. I'm sure you have too, where defendants would fill out a couple of different plea forms, maybe one for each count. I don't know what the practice was. I think this was in San Mateo County, perhaps. But excuse me, it's possible that is the practice there. So if I push back on you on that, what would you say?
I do think that's possible, but I also think that raises the question of why we have a plea form for the operating after revocation and not one for the operating while intoxicated. So in this case, it's not just that we have documents missing. It's that we have a case file that contains records of some things happening in the case. It contains a record of a plea being entered by the defendant to an operating after revocation. And we don't have an explanation as to why, given that we have that plea form and that record, why a separate plea form or a separate judgment of conviction indicating that there actually was a plea or conviction for the qualifying OWI offense would not also be retained. And the state in its arguments and in its brief, you know, has some explanations as to what happened procedurally with this case or why documents might be missing or why a particular record may not be noted in the docket, why it may not exist. And, but those are just speculation at this point. We don't know without actually having those records before us. There's no reason why the state prior to sentencing couldn't have answered these questions by perhaps calling someone in the clerk's office in California and getting an explanation or checking to see if these missing documents existed and trying to supplement the record that way. So given that it is the state's burden, these questions should be answered affirmatively by the state. We shouldn't be speculating as to why something that, you know, should exist and doesn't, it isn't there.
Counsel, Attorney, part of your client's acknowledgement that he had those prior convictions should we employ when we're weighing the evidence that's been presented both ways?
Chief Justice, I'm sorry, would you repeat the first part of your question?
Yeah, how should we weigh, as we're weighing the competing evidence here, how should we weigh your client's admission that he had those convictions?
Well, Your Honor, a defendant's admission, if it does exist, is competent proof and should be weighed the same as any other competent proof. In this case, we don't acknowledge that Mr. Loaiza did admit those offenses. For the reasons that I argued relating to the 1991 plea form and to the collateral attack, especially relating to the collateral attack, I think it's clear from the record in this case that Mr. Loaiza was disputing those prior conditions, that he entered a plea only on the basis that the state would be proving all of those prior convictions and that he was contesting their existence.
Well, I don't mean in Wisconsin. I mean the records from California. I understand that that was your tactic in Wisconsin courts, that he pled, and if they could prove them, fine, and if they couldn't, then you had to take yourself from where you were. I said my concern is what shows up in the California records for pleading.
Would be in the 1991 plea form?
Yes. Right.
Oh, I understand. Thank you for clarifying.
Sure.
So again, I think that, you know, those records should be given the same weight as any other record that's coming from California. And similar to my argument regarding the Wisconsin DOT record, that plea form, which appears to acknowledge a prior offense, or the DOT record, which lists a prior OWI offense, on their face, standing alone, a court may be able to find that that satisfies the preponderance of evidence standard. My argument here today is that the 1990 case file, the court must weigh that along with those other pieces of evidence, and that the discrepancies and the missing information from that case file, and I believe the way the Court of Appeals put it was that there are things that we would expect to see if there was a conviction that don't appear in the record. And it's that missing thing, those missing items that we would expect to see, that makes the other evidence unreliable. So I would say that this evidence, again, is just, it's weighed as a whole. The court looks at it together. A Department of Transportation record is not deemed more reliable than records from the actual case file. Similarly, I would argue a plea form in a subsequent case is not more reliable than documents from the actual case file. But the court needs to weigh all of that evidence together and then determine on balance which way it comes out, whether it comes out for the state's proposition or whether it comes out for the defendant's proposition.
Thank you.
Thank you. So because a sentence enhancement impacts the length of time that a defendant can be sentenced to, it does impact a liberty interest, and it must be the state's burden to prove any facts that the court uses to enhance. enhance a sentence. I'm concerned with the state's argument that a defendant must bring some proof, even if it's not to shift the burden or to affirmatively prove the absence of a conviction, but placing a burden on the defendant to rebut the state's contention, again, that is shifting the burden, and that's not appropriate in this context. Due process does require that the state faces that burden. And here where it's preponderance of the evidence, I don't think that's too much of a burden to place on the state. The other issue relating to the Fifth Amendment is that a defendant does retain their Fifth Amendment privileges to remain silent even after pleading guilty, even at sentencing, and a court cannot use the defendant's silence as an adverse inference when making a factual determination about something that could enhance the defendant's sentence. That it seems like that's what the state may be implying when it's arguing that Mr. Loaiza has never affirmatively stated that this conviction doesn't exist. What Mr. Loaiza needed to do in order to hold the state to his burden was just say he wanted the state to meet its burden. He does not have an obligation to present evidence, and he does not have an obligation to, you know, affirmatively deny that it exists. The case law is clear that it is the state's burden. We've had a number of cases, the state was listing them in his argument, where the court has applied this standard. It really is established and isn't in question. And so what we're asking the court to do here today is to not create a new rule, to not do anything that might shift the burden towards the defendant or even require that a defendant presents evidence or makes an affirmative denial that there is a prior conviction. What should be happening is that where a defendant either doesn't have the information about whether a prior offense exists or affirmatively denies the offense exists, the state is held to their proof, and the state does bring that proof forward, provides it to the court so as to show by a preponderance of the evidence that that prior conviction existed. Because it didn't happen here, the Court of Appeals appropriately found that 1990 conviction had not been proven. And I would also just like to get back to a point regarding the DOT records specifically. The state in its brief and somewhat in its argument today is making the argument that simply by providing that record, the state has proven that the prior offense occurs. And that is creating a special weight and attaching it to one piece of evidence. And there really is no support in the law for that. We don't have information. The state has not provided information about how the Department of Transportation compiles and maintains its records, what steps are taken to ensure their accuracy. The DOT record is different than a judgment of conviction, which is the actual judgment convicting the defendant.
But Ms. Laura, to that point, let me ask you then the question I asked Mr. Sanders, which is about paragraph 7 in the Court of Appeals opinion, which says a DOT record may be sufficiently reliable when that is the only information available, but additional information may cast doubt on the reliability of a DOT entry to a degree that makes the entry insufficiently reliable to meet the state's burden. Do you agree with that?
I do agree, and I think that's a very accurate statement of the law. So we know from the Van Riper case that a DOT record is admissible evidence in a trial for OWI PAC. And we also know that where that is the only piece of evidence in the record, that that is sufficient evidence. That was the Van Riper holding. So the Court of Appeals decision in this case, it doesn't conflict with Van Riper at all. What it says is that, and this is the same as any other case in which a circuit court has more than one piece of evidence, that the court must weigh the different pieces of evidence before it. And while a driving record, which states something, could be proof if there's nothing that conflicts with it, in this case, where we have the original case file that does call it into question, then we start to see that the driving record in Mr. Loiza's case maybe isn't reliable. And so the court may weigh that evidence, and if there is enough evidence on the other side to call the DOT record into question, then it can hold that it's not reliable regarding that entry in this case. We can see on the face of this driving record, and similarly, this is something that I noticed while reviewing the appendix prior to arguments, is that on page 158 of the appendix, this is the DOT record regarding the 1991 conviction that lists the same violation and conviction date of October 12th of 1991. So I would say it's extremely unlikely that Mr. Loiza was arrested for an OWI offense and convicted on the same day. And I believe the 1991 case file actually shows that those dates aren't accurate. So it is possible that the DOT record can contain inaccuracies. We know that dates are important, especially as we get back that far and around the 1989 cutoff line. Those dates are very important. And so an error in the DOT record can be very important. In this case, that error as to the dates in 1991 isn't, but it does show that this record is not infallible. And just as any other agency document can be, there can be errors in it. Finally, a final argument that the state made in its brief that I would like to address is just the issue of a defendant sort of laying in wait, allowing time to go by, waiting for case files to be destroyed, and then challenging the conviction. And the state cited to a case that dealt with that concern, the concern of sort of record retention laws and OWI prior convictions in the context of a collateral attack. This is distinguishable because a collateral attack is something that is raised by the defendant. And after the defendant makes their showing, then the state has to respond. In this case, we're talking again about a sentence enhancement. The state always has that burden of the sentence enhancement. The lack of a case file is not enough to overcome a DOT record. That's not something that we're arguing here today. We're arguing that because these records do exist, but don't show what the state is saying they show, that is what calls into question the reliability of the DOT driving record. So again, it's the state's burden to prove the existence of a prior conviction for sentence enhancement, and that burden must stay with the state. All evidence in the record relating to the prior conviction should be balanced as a whole. The DOT record is not entitled to special weight, and it cannot win the state's case in the face of conflicting evidence that calls into question its reliability. Here, where all the evidence was weighed, the balance of the evidence is insufficient to prove that there was a qualifying OWI conviction in 1990. And for that reason, the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. You prepared for rebuttal now, Attorney Sanders?
Yes.
Please begin.
Okay. So on the one side, we have the department record. We have the case file from the 1992 case where he plainly admitted to his 1990 case that he was convicted of OWI in California in 1990. We also have the collateral attack where he admitted that he was convicted of OWI in California in 1990. We also have what there is of the two case files from the 1990 case. And at the very best, that may not prove, if that's all the state had, that might not prove that he was convicted of an OWI in that case. It might. If you look at the whole thing, it shows that he was placed on probation for count one, which was a drunk driving, and that was revoked. So I think that if that helps the state's case, at the very least, that is not enough to show that the department record is wrong and that his 1992 case is wrong. And when he admitted it in his collateral attack, he was wrong. And it's not enough to show that in all of his past convictions in this state, he's got five more, that in those, I would think the department record showed the same thing. And there's no indication that in any of those cases, he said, no, wait, that's wrong.
Counsel, your opposing counsel attempts to circumscribe your argument, perhaps fairly so or unfairly so. So I want to ask you, are you advancing that the defendant has an obligation to present evidence in this sentence enhancement case?
I am not, but I want to be clear that in the opinion of the Court of Appeals here, in paragraph six, it has a quote from this case, from this court in Saunders, where it said, put simply, judicial personnel are not infallible. Accordingly, even a certified copy of a document establishing a conviction may be rebutted. And that is, of course, true. But that means it has to rebut it. You have to rebut it. So the defendant, it's not like the defendant has to present evidence, but if the evidence which shows a conviction is not rebutted, it proves what it was put in to prove. So it's not a burden.
Well, it might be burdensome to some, who knows. It seems that your argument at least is touching upon an obligation to make a prima facie showing vis-a-vis a burden of production. And I'm not sure sometimes it's hard to draw these lines. And so I'm very mindful of that. But that's why I get back to the question that I asked. And is it your position the defendant does not have an obligation to present evidence?
Yes. But if the defendant fails to, in I think every case, the defendant is going to lose. If there's a department record or if there is a judgment which shows it, in a case like this where the state has provided more, of course a defendant can point to that and say, well, yeah, if you look at that too, it shows that the department record is not sufficiently reliable. It's just that in this case, it is. And what the defendant points to from the 1990 case helps the state's case, and at the very least, doesn't help the defendant's case. It doesn't show that his department record is not reliable. At the very best for the defendant, it it shows nothing. And that makes perfect sense because it is from 1990. It's in a state like Wisconsin where a court record can be thrown out long before this long has passed. And plainly in this case, because there are only a couple of documents in that record, most of what was in that record is gone. There is almost nothing in that record. So it makes no sense to assume that because there are things which would most commonly be found in a court record, but aren't here, that those didn't at one time exist, because it's obvious that there are only a couple of things here. And there is not a conviction for the OWI, but there also isn't one for the OAR. There is nothing about sentencing. There's nothing about anything. It's not a complete record, and a court shouldn't look at a court record from that long ago, which plainly is not complete, and draw from that some kind of an inference that his department record is wrong, and that the conviction from his 1991 case, which shows that he admitted to his 1990 conviction, is wrong, and that when he admitted it in his collateral attack motion, he was wrong. It just doesn't really make any sense.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, counsel. And thank you both for interesting argument and for proceeding with the court on our remote oral arguments. Hopefully one day we'll all be able to get back together in the courtroom. But for now, I think this helps us because you're able to come here and present your arguments as well as the briefs, which are very good. It's a very interesting issue. So I thank you both. We are going to adjourn now as we all prepare for our second case of the morning. We are adjourned.